You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
For 5 years, the FBI suspected that a scientist named Stephen Hatfield was responsible for the 2001 anthrax letter attacks, which killed five and infected 17 others. It wasn't until 2005 that they realized they had suspected the wrong man. A scientific breakthrough shifted the investigation to U.S. Army microbiologist Bruce Ivins, an anthrax researcher whom the FBI had consulted throughout the investigation. By the time they realized their mistake, Mr. Hatfield's professional career had been irreparably damaged by media coverage of the investigation, and Mr. Ivins was still handling anthrax at his lab. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Willman tells the story in his latest book, The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks, and America's Rush to War. It's published by Bantam Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Good to be with you.
To whom were the anthrax letters sent?
The anthrax letters were sent to the parent company of the National Enquirer in Lantana, Florida. They were sent, we know, to then-Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, to Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Pat Leahy, to quote-unquote editor of the New York Post, and to Tom Brokaw, anchor of NBC News.
There doesn't seem to be any consistency there. It's not a left or right kind of thing.
I think what I found in my research is that the through line, if you will, is that the perpetrator was going for maximum attention and impact, wanted to create a crisis atmosphere. And I think if you look at it through that lens, it was very skillfully executed.
And how many letters were actually sent?
Well, we know that five were sent, four were recovered. The one in South Florida, the quote-unquote index case, where a photo editor named Robert Stevens ultimately died of inhalational anthrax, that letter was never recovered. Who was expecting anthrax at that time? And the onset of the symptoms takes a while before the trash is taken out and incinerated in a landfill. However, the FBI forensics did map a plume of anthrax from the mailroom at the parent offices of the National Enquirer all the way through various floors where the poor gentleman who was pushing the mail cart was spreading it.
Well, anthrax has a number of different strains. I'm assuming that all the letters contain the same strain.
They did contain the same strain. It was the Ames strain. And this is something that fascinated me when I dug in on this book, when I talked to the lead geneticist who was brought in as a consultant by the FBI, a fellow named Paul Keim at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, Arizona. And within 24 hours of receiving a sample of Robert Stevens' cerebrospinal fluid from South Florida, Keim and his team in Flagstaff and a separate team at the CDC in Atlanta, using Keim's technique, confirmed that it was the Ames strain. And that was a really chilling moment for someone as knowledgeable as Keim, because it showed it was a laboratory strain.
Well, I received mail. I just opened it up. How come more people weren't affected?
Well, more people, of course, were. Two of the people who died didn't receive, to best we can tell, an anthrax-laced letter. They received cross-contaminated mail, and that was a woman named Kathy Nguyen, who worked here in Manhattan, lived in the Bronx, and a woman named Audalie Lundgren from Oxford, Connecticut. Later on, mail handling facilities where their mail was processed were found to have spores. So we had five deaths that we know about. We have 17 confirmed skin or cutaneous infections and inhalational anthrax.
And anthrax comes in spores? So what is it officially? It's not a bacteria. It's not...
Yes, it is.
Oh,
it is?
It is
a bacterium, yes. It commonly afflicts actually grazing animals. Cattle and deer die around the world, including in this country, every year from it.
When the FBI investigation began, what evidence did they have?
Well, they had four of the letters. They had the material in the letters and not a lot else. The letters, you'll recall, were designed to suggest an Islamic extremist message and designed to appear as if they were right on the heels of Al-Qaeda and September the 11th.
In fact, they said things like death to Israel, death to what was it?
Death to America, death to Israel, yes. And this is, to jump ahead just a second, what is really one of the most eerie things when I dug in here on my research is that the first wave of anthrax-laced letters were postmarked September 18, 2001. On September 21, 2001, Bruce Ivins, who was a microbiologist for the United States Army at Fort Detrick, Maryland, sent an email to a woman who he had a very obsessive relationship with, but he always wanted her attention, and he wanted the scientific validation in the community, certainly from her. And he used very parallel language to what was in the then unknown anthrax letter.
Well, it was death in America, death to Israel. Allah is great. But some of the letters also contain a message, take penicillin, misspelled.
Yes.
It said, take penicillin now. And I'm assuming that he misspelled it because he wanted to make it appear like it wasn't from somebody who was in the sciences.
I believe so. I think he also said, we have this anthrax. But he said, take this penicillin. And, you know, each one of the recovered letters had transparent tape sealing all the seams. So the perpetrator was not trying to rain anthrax through the mail. He wanted that anthrax to get to its destination for maximum shock and awe impact.
And why did the FBI come to focus on Stephen Hatfill as the perpetrator? Who's he?
Well, Stephen Hatfill is a virologist. His specialty is working with viruses. He had worked at Fort Detrick, at the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick, Maryland, which is the biowarfare research center for the United States military. Hatfill had worked there from 97 to the fall of 99, handling viruses. He's a swashbuckling guy, a bragger, who inflated various aspects of his resume, and a handful of his associates sort of dropped a dime on him and said to the authorities, you know, you really ought to look hard at this guy. And as I say in my book, which has not come out before, there was a polygrapher, someone who was conducting a lie detector test routinely for security clearances, who after the anthrax letter attacks called the Bureau and said, you know, you ought to look at this guy. And so that took fire. There was an activist up here in New York who was privately strongly suggesting that that Hatfill, without naming him, was the guy.
So he's somebody who just sent off alarm bells. And that was enough of a reason for the FBI to focus on him for 5 years?
Well, it was enough of a reason to look really hard at him initially. The other thing is that Stephen Hatfill had gotten several prescriptions of Cipro in 2001. Turns out he had a deviated septum. He was actually undergoing surgery on the day of 9/11. So it turns out in the end he had a legitimate basis, but you had to look at him hard. But for 5 years, no. And the reason why that the FBI stayed on him, that I point out in a piece today in the Boston Globe in an op-ed, is, and it's in the book, are the FBI's faith in these bloodhounds, these magical bloodhounds that had these magical omniscient powers, which turned out to be a spectacular wrong turn.
Well, didn't the media report that he was a primary suspect? That was based on a leak? Do we know who leaked it?
No, we don't. the case file, so to speak, for the anthrax case, turns out, was open to probably thousands of people. And details from that were rained out on a very systematic basis to a number of people in the media. And Stephen Hatfill was ground chuck before he even really almost hired a lawyer.
So do you think it would have been the FBI or somebody in the Bush administration?
Well,
there was a lot of leaking going on at the time.
There was a lot of leaking going on. There was a couple of individuals who in the United States Attorney's Office in Washington at that time, the U.S. Attorney himself, who was a Bush administration appointee, who has acknowledged under oath that he was a confidential source to a couple of media outlets and provided details that obviously should not have been provided. I don't think in his case that was for an ideological purpose. There were other ideologues within the administration that seized on other aspects.
Well, I always wonder why they would even bother to leak that kind of information. Is it to hurt Hatfill when he finally comes up to trial, or did they just want to have were they frustrated that he might get away with it, so they wanted to wreak some kind of revenge on him?
I guess what I would say is that the people who are connected with the investigation, and that would include people in the U.S. Attorney's Office, they were under enormous pressure to solve this case. Bear in mind that in the aftermath of September the 11th, the FBI, everyone in federal law enforcement, was being called incompetent, and not without some reason. They failed to interdict to prevent 9/11. And then here are the anthrax letter attacks. What's going on, fellas? What do you got for us today? And so Stephen Hatfill looks like a live suspect. And, boy, they wanted to get on him. They wanted media reinforcement of that to show the public, to show the Congress we're in charge.
My guest is David Willman. His latest book, The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attack, and America's Rush to War, is published by Bantam. Was the same kind of anthrax in the mailings ever matched with samples collected from Hatfill's home or his lab?
No, never. And Stephen Hatfill after he left Fort Detrick in September of 1999, never had access to a biocontainment laboratory, which is a crucial point. The other crucial point is that Stephen Hatfield did not have up-to-date anthrax vaccinations. I mean, you talk about a fool's errand squared. There's no way he was going to be working with live anthrax under those situations.
And they went after him. They actually suggested that he be fired from a job in academia.
Correct. It was actually more than a suggestion. It was entirely coercive. Stephen Hatfield, after he had lost his one job at a defense intelligence contractor in the greater Washington area, got a gig with Louisiana State University teaching courses in biopreparedness, that sort of thing, at $150,000 a year. It was funded by a Justice Department grant, and Justice Department officials went to LSU and said, terminate it.
Now, why wasn't Bruce Ivins even looked upon as a possibility? He was working with anthrax and the kind of anthrax that was involved in this case.
This is a huge error that is a big part of this book and this story. Was the FBI's failure to see this figure right in their plain sight. Bruce Ivins was the go-to anthrax expert at Fort Detrick. In fact, the FBI was consulting with him early on about the scientific niceties of Bacillus anthracis.
Must have thought this was hilarious.
Well, he was loving the attention, and he had predicted again on September 26th of 2001 in an email to another woman whose attentions and scientific validation he craved, that that we're about to have another big event, and we here at Fort Detrick are going to be on call 24/7. We're going to be at the epicenter just like we were in the Persian Gulf War. But the big initial blunder, I think, there are two of them on the FBI's part with Bruce Ivins, and I think it's only fair to judge institutions and people on what they knew in real time. Bruce Ivins had spent this series of late nights in the hot suites at Fort Detrick alone and with no plausible explanation for why he was there in the run-up to both separate matches of anthrax letter attacks. Those key card records, this electronically documented, were handed over to the FBI in the first half of 2002, of course, along with scores of other people up there, but they weren't even looked at for at least two or three more years.
And he had not put into his records of his work anything that he was doing at that time. He just was kind of in the lab.
He was in the lab. He had checked for other colleagues as to whether or not there were some dead mice or dead rabbits in certain experiments. But when you talk about going into a hot suite, you're talking about showering in, putting on special gear, and then showering out. And you're spending, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 hours a night for, you know, 11 straight nights and then another block the same.
It's how had he originally become involved with anthrax research?
Well, he's a Ph.D. microbiologist from University of Cincinnati. He was hired into Fort Detrick by the United States Army as a civilian scientist as of December 1980. Why? Because there had been a crisis. There had been a huge accident in Sverdlovsk of the old Soviet Union in the Ural Mountains. And what turned out to be the biggest accident in the history of bioweapons production. Anthrax plume released and killed scores of people. And this the fear for the American defense national security community is that the Russians are still ongoing with an illicit bioweapons program. Maybe their new anthrax bug might defeat a vaccine. So Ivins was hired in to try and start testing our existing vaccine stock to see if it would defeat the hottest strain that could be found. And the Army found the hottest strain that they had ever had from a dead cow in Texas very soon after Bruce Ivins was hired.
So he was really hired to find ways to counteract any germ warfare from the Soviet Union. What did his colleagues think of him?
His colleagues generally found him to be a very quirky guy, but a wisecracking guy, an odd fellow, but the kind of guy who you like to have around as a jester. I mean, he would juggle in the office, juggle fruit. He was very clever at the keyboard and would compose going away songs with clever lyrics for people. So, I mean, he had those things going for him. And he was always, as I say in the book, extremely deferential to the uniformed personnel at Fort Detrick, and that's an important dynamic because you have this schism between uniformed and civilian. And the civilians, that's where most of your PhDs are. The uniforms, they don't have those scientific chops, and here's this guy who calls every guy he's known for 18 years colonel. They love it.
My guest is David Willman, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who's reporting for the Los Angeles Times, brought to light the pivotal developments surrounding the 2001 anthrax letter attacks. His book, The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks and America's Rush to War, is published by Bantam Books. We'll continue our conversation after this. My guest is David Willman, whose book, The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks and America's Rush to War, is published by Bantam. You go into his background, describing his hometown, Lebanon, Ohio, as embodying the small-town America of Norman Rockwell, and you talk about his troubled childhood. His mother dominated and actually physically abused his father to the point where his father had to go to the hospital?
Well, to the point where his father was receiving medical treatment. There's one dramatic moment in the book, and this was a shocker to me when I was sitting with one of Bruce's former contemporaries who happened to live almost right across the street. There was a doctor who lived some 300 yards down from the Ivins household, and he gets a call at 2 in the morning. And the call is from Mary Ivins, Bruce's mother, saying, "Ralph, come down here. I've killed Randall." Okay, so Dr. Young gets out of his house and hightails it down to the Ivins house. And to his great shock, Randall answers the door with his head caked in blood, pressing a towel up against it. In that occasion, Dr. Young treated him on the spot and sent him a bill.
Well, I have to wonder what kind of impact this had on young Bruce. Was she as physically abusive with him?
I don't think she was.
Or as controlling?
Absolutely controlling. As some of the most valuable sources for me, obviously, were his classmates, but classmates who also worked in Ivins Drugs, where Bruce Ivins' father was a pharmacist. This is a family-owned drugstore that came into existence in 1893. And so Randall Ivins was a proprietor, the senior pharmacist. And so these women who worked there and one of the other pharmacists, who's now pushing 80, told me to a person, Bruce was programmed by her. Now, that's what they say. How can I really know? But she was a dominating force in his life, and he was complaining about her and really deeply resented her into his 60s.
Is that why, as you said earlier, he tended to obsess on women he had crushes on?
Could be. I mean,
well, he when he was an adult, his aunt told him that he was an unplanned pregnancy and that his mother even tried to abort him. That's very, not the sort of thing you want to hear.
Very true, and that was something that Bruce Ivins would also, in years thereafter, would confide to close colleagues. Again, the anecdote is just it's saddening. Mary Ivins tried to abort him in a very crude way.
And then obsessed on him herself. Yes. But all this is sad, but many people come from troubled homes and don't mail deadly bacterium to politicians and reporters.
Very true. So again, I'm not going to practice without a license on nature versus nurture here, but Bruce Ivins was a deeply troubled individual from the time he was in grade school, high school, into the University of Cincinnati. And one common denominator all the way through was he was always seeking attention and approval, which became later in life scientific validation.
And then you said also he had a certain obsessive quality, obsessed on a sorority, Kappa Kappa Gamma.
That is correct. The genesis of it, as best we can trace, was as he was an undergrad at the University of Cincinnati. He asked a young woman out for a date. She said no. She moved on and actually, I believe, forgot about it, but he never did. And he attributed the rejection to her membership in Kappa Kappa Gamma. So he started casing the Kappa house at the University of Cincinnati, and it just became a lifelong obsession that lasted into his 60s. He committed two burglaries of Kappa houses where he stole artifacts. Then he sold copies of what for him was the Holy Grail, the Book of Ritual from Kappa Kappa Gamma. He put ads in Rolling Stone and Mother Jones magazine, and he didn't sell it. He gave it away for free.
How aware were other people of this sort of thing?
Not aware. I mean, this was part of the compartmentalized mirage aspect of Bruce Ivins. People did not know he was committing burglaries. They did not know he was going in and stealing a doctoral student's lab book, who was a Kappa member, but she was a faculty mentor at that time, stole her lab book upon which her doctorate hinged, and then provided her with an anonymous note saying, "You can find your lab book in this mailbox here in Chapel Hill." She had the authorities. They found the lab book in that mailbox.
Did he ever marry? Did he ever have a real relationship with a woman?
He married a woman while he was a graduate student at the University of Cincinnati and remained married to her until his death on July 29th of 2008.
Now, you were talking about the concern in this country about coming up with some kind of a vaccine for anthrax. We've never really come up with one that has been totally satisfactory, have we?
Well, that is correct. As you'll recall, it became a huge controversy that has never really gone away in the aftermath of the Persian Gulf War. We had the military had very limited stock of anthrax vaccine, and it was given to not very many service personnel who were deployed to the Gulf, but a lot of complaints about adverse reactions ranging from at the point of contact with the needle, huge lumps, to concerns about autoimmune diseases.
And there were even some people who got into trouble with the military because they refused to be vaccinated.
There were more than a few courts martial of people who refused to take that vaccination.
So there was a real concern that Saddam Hussein was going to unleash anthrax on the American military if we invaded in the first Gulf War?
Very much so. And in fact,
evidence at all, any more than the yellow cake that we were concerned about later?
I think we have to say that in retrospect, there's definite evidence that Saddam Hussein was trying to develop a biological weapons capacity. He didn't pull it off, and perhaps because he was threatened with nuclear weapons going into the Persian Gulf War, perhaps he didn't deploy what he could have deployed. But the fascinating thing for me here, again, in doing this research, is that Bruce Ivins was enlisted with a very small corps of people at Fort Detrick to help prepare a vaccine and to see if an antibiotic would work in the event of an attack in the Persian Gulf War in the run-up to the war. Remember, we had Desert Storm before we had the war itself. But in any event, he was right in the middle of it. He was totally animated by that excitement. And I think most importantly, he learned a very lasting lesson that in this country, crisis moves bureaucracy. You can have all these rules of safety and efficacy for new medical products, even for the military, but when you're faced with crisis, the rules go out the window. It happened in the Persian Gulf War, and guess what? It happened with the anthrax vaccine, the FDA-approved vaccine, which was in suspension because of problems with it after the anthrax letter attacks.
So when he was sending these letters, he was trying to create a crisis that would benefit his career?
Well, he was trying to create a crisis that generated maximum attention on him and the people at Fort Detrick who were going to save the country from this menace. Secondly,
this is like the fireman who sets fires so that he can then become the hero when he puts them out.
That exact analogy was described to me by a former superior of Bruce Ivins who supervised him in the late 80s into 1990-91. That's exactly how he saw Bruce Ivins then and how he sees him in the aftermath of the anthrax letter attacks. Now, the other crucial piece of information here, Leonard, is that Bruce Ivins, from the early to mid-1980s on, even before the Persian Gulf War, was trying to develop a next-generation anthrax vaccine that was genetically engineered that would be superior to the existing anthrax vaccines, which, as we know, is greatly troubled. It turns out he got two patents as a co-inventor on that product. As we come into 2000-2001, that experimental product is dead in the water. In the words of the supervising major general who I interviewed, who's talked to this issue for the first time in this book, the next generation anthrax vaccine was beyond the back burner. Everything changed with the anthrax letter attacks. Immediately we had the crisis. We had something called Project BioShield that was passed by Congress and President Bush signed it into law. And the first contract awarded under Project BioShield was for $877.5 million for the exact next generation anthrax vaccine product upon which Bruce Ivins was a patent holder.
Was his vaccine promising?
It was promising, as most new experimental products are before they are subjected to the hard test of not only animal testing but human testing. It turned out that product has yet to make it to shore.
My guest is David Willman, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, author of The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks and America's Rush to War, published by Bantam Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When you talk about America's rush to war, are we talking about the first Gulf War or the second Gulf War?
We're talking about the second Gulf War. And the reason why that ties into the book is that almost immediately the anthrax letter attacks were exploited by a whole constellation of people who were very interested in seeing this country attack Saddam Hussein as being somehow culpable for not only the anthrax letter attacks but for 9/11. And this was amplified by wildly inaccurate media accounts, as I exhaustively, I think, document here in this book.
So it wasn't his intention to get us to go to war, but there was that sentiment in Washington that we had to find reasons to go after Saddam Hussein, and this would be one of them?
Well, I mean, there are key people, as we know.
I mean, there was anybody out there who was even trying to link Hatfield to Saddam Hussein.
I never heard that one exactly, although there's one column that comes to mind that rather oddly was saying, while suggesting that Stephen Hatfield anonymously at that point was the culprit, was suggesting that if the FBI doesn't get on the stick and solve this case, that the culprit's going to escape to Iraq or some other foreign country. That was pretty weird. But the finger was on Iraq. Obviously, we know now that, and we should have known then, that Don Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz and others, you know, were after Saddam Hussein since the first Gulf War. They wrote a letter to then-President Clinton in 1998 saying the only solution is to take Saddam out. So 9/11, the anthrax letter attacks were just a gift in their lap. And we had this wildly inaccurate speculation from half-cocked people at Fort Detrick who were flying all around Washington, the White House, the Pentagon, saying that the anthrax sent to Senator Daschle was linkable to Saddam Hussein's program, absolutely false, and really yet to be, to this day, thoroughly retracted and corrected.
How did the anthrax attacks play into the passage of the Patriot Act?
Well, it factored in very critically from a timing standpoint. I think the Patriot Act may have been on its way to being passed based on 9/11 alone. However, Senator Leahy, with the support of then Senator Leahy, of course, was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, with the support of Majority Leader Daschle, wanted to do what is done in the Senate, to take a little more time to really study this. Let's think about it. Let's make sure we know what's in the bill. And I've been told by people on both sides of the aisle and both sides of Congress, House and Senate, that the anthrax letter attacks game over. And if I went back and retraced the record and I quote from people in there, Senator Spector, who you can't ask for a more seasoned member of the United States than him, he cited the anthrax attacks on the floor of the United States Senate when the Senate voted, I believe, 98-1 in favor of ramming that thing through. And in the House, the legislation really wasn't even read thoroughly.
Well, there was mention of weaponized anthrax in the news. And this was seen as weaponized anthrax. Are there naturally occurring anthrax infections in the country?
Well, there are naturally occurring anthrax infections, very, very rare among humans,
you got to get them from a cow.
You can get them from hides, handling animal hides, sometimes drum skins, but extremely rare. Usually it's a skin infection, not an inhalational anthrax case. I mean, to get an inhalational anthrax case is extraordinary. The term weaponized anthrax is really almost so ambiguous as to be unhelpful.
Well, ABC News broke a story that suggested a possible involvement with Saddam Hussein. Did they ever apologize?
Never did. That was a much ballyhooed story that their chief investigative correspondent, Brian Ross, broke, I believe, on October 26, 2001.
Where did he get it from? Do you think it was something that was fed to him by the government, or did somebody in Iraq inform him of this?
As best I can reconstruct, he got it from anonymous sources, from people who were, shall we say, connected with the greater Fort Detrick community. The sourcing was always anonymous. The two people who he had on camera, who were not direct sources but by implication were certainly confirming, told me in my research for this book, in my interviews, that they had no firsthand knowledge.
So how did the FBI eventually decide it wasn't Hatfield and it might be Ivins?
Well, there was a war within the FBI investigation on exactly this point. And so this investigation was not turned away from Stephen Hatfield until the fall of 2006, when FBI Director Mueller's long-handpicked person to lead the case had transferred down to Knoxville, Tennessee, and off the anthrax case. He remained absolutely convinced that Stephen Hatfield was a perpetrator. But two highly seasoned veteran agents were brought in to take over leadership of the case. And the first thing they did was they told everyone on the task force, look, time out. We're going to reassess all assumptions. We're going to reassess all leads and suspects. What we're going to do is we're going to look at who had access to the anthrax, and we're going to work it out from there in more of a logical way than this sort of channeling way you would do with saying that bloodhounds can tell you who's responsible for what scent. And that work there, combined, as you said earlier, with the genetic analyses, began pointing ultimately toward one person and one person only.
And was he aware that they were starting to look at him?
He was aware of his potential risk in this investigation from a point way earlier than that. I mean, because he was helping the FBI investigation as a consultant from late 2001 into 2002, he was among the first people who was given a polygraph examination because the FBI wanted to do what they could to screen to see whether or not they had the perpetrator in their midst. And a polygraph is a highly imperfect way of screening people. I mean, it's not admissible in court as evidence. That, I think, is a pretty good indication that it's not very much a hard science. Bruce Ivins was freaking out over having to take the polygraph. He did take the polygraph and seemingly passed, although both the Bureau and the United States Postal Service later concluded that he had taken measures, overt measures, to defeat the polygraph. Be that as it may, Bruce Ivins became more and more outspoken and agitated that he was going to be targeted. He was saying these things way before he was targeted. I have an anecdote in the book. September 2005, Bruce Ivins was at a scientific conference down in New Mexico and said at that conference, just berated an FBI scientist who's not an agent, that he's being harassed, his family's being harassed, et cetera, et cetera. And when, in fact, he wasn't under any surveillance, he was certainly not being harassed.
So was he ever arrested?
No, he was not. He made some very specific, very frightening threats at a group therapy meeting on July 9th, I want to say, of 2008, in which he said that he was going to be indicted for the anthrax letter attacks, and he was not going to go down. He was going to take all the people out who had done him wrong, the investigators, some of his colleagues, et cetera. And so the group therapy therapist, in consultation with another therapist from the practice, then contacted the authorities, and he was led out of Fort Detrick by Frederick police on February 10th and committed to a psychiatric institution for the better part of 2 weeks, and shortly thereafter purchased Tylenol and overdose on a massive dose of Tylenol PM.
He had been in under psychiatric treatment for a long time, but there's no way the psychiatrist could have revealed what he was saying to them?
This is really, I think, gets at a really important point, Leonard, is what did the Army know? When did they know it? It turns out that Bruce Ivins was under psychiatric treatment going back to the late 1970s. But yet he was hired by the Army in December of 1980 and given a secret-level security clearance. And one of the more shocking things that I found in my research was, in response to a Freedom of Information Act request, is that from the time he was hired in December 1980 through the time of his death in July of 2008, the United States Army never sought to vet his psychological fitness to handle anthrax. Now, we could get into more detail, if you wish, about what the Army could have known. On annual forms, Bruce Ivins actually disclosed that he was taking certain antidepressants, anti-anxiety drugs, and that he was in talk therapy, outpatient therapy. Now, you shouldn't be stigmatized by these things, obviously, and credit to him for seeking treatment. However, what needs to happen, and what certainly happens in aspects of chemical warfare and nuclear warfare operations, is that when anything like that arises, it might signal some instability or potential problem. A timeout is called. The person is withdrawn from sensitive work, and people try to get a handle on what's going on. That was never done, even though this information was available in real time. What Ivins withheld from his annual disclosures was that as of July 2000, he was placed on Zyprexa, which, of course, is an antipsychotic. He withheld that information.
This doesn't give me much of a feeling of confidence in the way my government operates in major crises. What happened to Stephen Hatfield?
Well, Stephen Hatfield hired a lawyer and sued the FBI and the Justice Department on grounds of violating his rights of privacy with these the torrent of leaks of prejudicial investigative details. And in June, late June of 2008, after the judge in the case, by the way, had said a couple months earlier, the judge in the case had access to all the sworn testimony gathered in Hatfield's litigation, as I ultimately gained access to. Plus, the judge had access to the case summary memos prepared by the lead FBI investigator, the ones that supposedly pointed toward Hatfield as a perpetrator. And the judge, Judge Reggie Walton, the United States District Judge in Washington, declared from the bench that there is, quote, not a scintilla of evidence, unquote, that Hatfield was in any way responsible for the anthrax letter attacks. So Hatfield won a legal settlement from the government for $5.82 million.
Well, that makes retirement a lot easier, but his career was ruined, I suspect. And even now, if Stephen Hatfield walks into a job interview, he probably has to go through a whole thing of explaining, well, I didn't really do it.
What Stephen Hatfield has told me in my interviews with him is that his career as a serious scientist is over.
Mm-hmm. What's he doing? Just living on – that's a lot of millions of dollars.
Well, it's somewhat attenuated. In other words, he gets some cash up front, and then there's sort of an annuity that's paid tax-free. I think that's sort of geared to that $150,000 a year that he was stripped of by that intervention by the Justice Department.
David Willman's book is The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks, and America's Rush to War. It's published by Bantam. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. Great to be here.